That was Marsyas 2 by Olga Neuwirth, played by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music in London, flautist Thomas Hancox, viola player Richard Waters, cellist Peiji Ng, and pianist Daniel Leipart. And it ends tonight's Proms Composer Portrait of Olga Neuwirth. It was presented by Andrew McGregor earlier today at the Royal College of Music. This is BBC Radio 3. Well, now it's time for some highlights from the Proms Plus Late, recorded on Saturday evening after the main prom concert. It's introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Thank you. Well, good evening and welcome to late night jazz and poetry in the Elgar Room, right up in the rafters of the Royal Albert Hall. Tonight we have music from the relatively newly formed Chris Maddock Quintet. They're going to be performing in a bit. But first of all, we'll be hearing from the poet Sam Rivier. He's a founding editor of Stop Sharpening Your Knives. And his new anthology, 81 Austerities, came out just at the beginning of August. Please put your hands together for Sam Rivier.
This poem's called Year of the Rabbit. There is no purer form of advertising than writing a poem. That's what the monk told me. If I were a conceptual artist, I would make high-budget trailers of John Updike novels, but no actual movie. The scene where Angstrom drives towards the end of his life, down a street in the suburbs, lined with a type of tree he's never bothered to identify, and laden with white blossoms reflecting slickly in the windscreen. I would fade in the music as the old song was fading out, keeping the backing vocals at the same distance, kind of balancing the silence. The word rabbit appears in 10-foot trebuchet. This is called Dream Poem. I know what you're thinking. It's dull and their sex dreams, dreams about violent murders. Mine are pretty banal. I dreamed I wrote a poem beginning hi and ending see you later. The middle part was amazing. That's the part I don't remember. I was sitting on a platform high above the jungle. This all feels really familiar, probably from something I've seen on TV. I was dressed up as a witch doctor and used this stick of judgment, taking back the names of creatures, restoring them to myth. I was doing wisely with it. In my dream, the poem didn't have this assonance that's creeping in. After I'd taken back everything, I kept hold of my stick, using it to designate the categories that really matter, while adding bones and wings to my hat, sitting up here out of danger. I hate this, I like that. This is a poem about spending the entire day indoors. Heavily. Today is a day of zero connectivity. I brush my teeth and dunk my face in water, which is what you wash your breasts with. I want to use the exact same soap and drink orange juice, probably from Spain. Now there is a jellied light in the kitchen and outside the same air we all have to breathe. The day is in some kind of tank. All I will do is think of increasingly horrible things to tell you, striking the side of my head for a new image. There is no competing with the spectacular and obvious. Am I not a child at the opera of emotions? I was listening to the rap artist Ghostface Killah on the train, and I misheard one of his lyrics. I thought he said, "My face saw her magazine," which I thought was this amazingly complicated statement about surfaces and appearance and desire and stuff like that. Actually, he said, "My face on her magazine," meaning the woman he was thinking of approaching in the rap song was reading a magazine with his own face on the cover of it, which is probably a good thing for him. Anyway, I preferred the line I misheard, so I chose that as a starting point to write a poem. My face saw her magazine. Across the moonscapes of skate parks, you are 13 years old and no longer allowed to play with boys. On platform 6, wearing your amazing cape, you are not in fact you, but someone else. Well, I'm someone who misses lyrics, resulting in a more beautiful but private understanding. With your dark fringe, white shirt and straw hat, you are the palest goth at the picnic. Resolutely uncharmed by my very charming friend, you are the poster of disinterest. In bed and matching underwear, you are disguising the tunnel we dug in the American prison. Not answering my texts, what you are is the briefcase glowing with golden contents. I realize I can only look into one eye at a time. It is pure propaganda, the pupil a blot of blackest inkjet ink. In your luxury woolen garments, you are an advertisement for luxury woolen garments. And then you wink. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Thank you.
was Amsterdam by the Chris Maddox Quintet, ending tonight's selection of highlights from Proms Plus Late, recorded on Saturday in the Elgar Room of the Royal Albert Hall in London. The poet Sam Riviere read from his own work, and the programme was produced, I beg your pardon, introduced by Sarah Moore Peach. BBC Radio 3, it's just gone a quarter to 11, and time now for the essay, which this week is devoted to Percy Grainger, the Australian-born composer and pianist. This week we've three eminent musicians talking about different aspects of Grainger, and the focus tonight is folk song, which was one of Grainger's major enthusiasms and preoccupations. Here's the writer and director of the Cheltenham Music Festival, Myrig Bowen.
Imagine this. You are a frail old man in your 80s or 90s, once a farm labourer, sailor or cart driver, and now seeing out your days quietly in rural Gloucestershire. A swanky car draws up to where you're living and some well-dressed, well-to-do, cheerful people pile out. You don't know it because they appear to be from another world, but these visitors include an ex-prime minister, a well-known novelist, a famous painter, a dashing young concert pianist, and a couple of society hostesses, one of whom is the long-term mistress of the ex-prime minister. The pianist, quite a lot younger than the rest, bounds up to you and asks you if you know any songs. You do. Your head has been full of songs for the whole of your life, and you start singing them, not just to the assembled party, but to a high-tech recording device that you've never seen or even dreamt of before. This scenario may seem a little far-fetched if you try to imagine it taking place in contemporary Britain. Would an ex-PM, a novelist, a painter, a pianist and some posh girlfriends ever be hanging out together, I wonder, let alone visiting doddery folk singers in Gloucestershire? But it's exactly what happened just over a century ago, in April 1908. We're at Winchcombe Workhouse, a few miles north of Cheltenham, in the company of Arthur Balfour, Prime Minister between 1902 and 5, Lady Elcho of Stanway House, the painter John Singer Sargent and the writer H.G. Wells. The pianist is Percy Grainger, star musical turn of Edwardian London's aristocratic soirees and, with his debonair fresh-faced enthusiasm, the charismatic Australian eye candy of many a weekend country house gathering. I describe Grainger as a pianist here because this was how most people would have known him then, a stylish recitalist and foremost interpreter of the piano concerto by Grieg, whom he'd met and befriended in London in 1906. But Grainger's talents as a composer and arranger were increasingly coming to the fore during the decade or so that he and his mother based themselves in London before their departure to the United States at the start of World War I. And by the time of that Gloucestershire visit in April 1908, Grainger was a seasoned collector of folk songs, effectively in the dual role as self-appointed musical anthropologist and opportunist composer seeking authentically rustic, timeless melodic source material. If it was Lady Elcho's hospitality at Stanway House that facilitated Grainger's so-called folk fishing cruises around Gloucestershire, it was the similar hospitality of the Carrie Elwes family at their country seat in Brigg, Lincolnshire, that started Grainger off with folk song collection a couple of years before that. During the course of four separate trips to Brigg in 1905 and 6, Grainger collected over 300 tunes from 60 or more singers, the majority of them men. One of these was the winner of the inaugural folk song prize at Brigg's North Lincolnshire Musical Competition on the 11th of April 1905. Joseph Taylor was a 72-year-old bailiff on the Elwes estate at Brigg, and alongside his winning entry, Creeping Jane, Taylor sang a number of other songs to Grainger, including Brigg Fair. That day, Grainger transcribed it the way that people like Lucy Broadwood, Cecil Sharp and Vaughan Williams were doing at the time, with pencil and paper. On his fourth trip to Lincolnshire in the summer of 1906, he had with him an Edison Bell phonograph and recorded Taylor's singing for posterity on wax cylinder. He subsequently used his clout as a popular recording artist to get the Gramophone Company, later HMV, to make commercial recordings of Taylor singing nine songs in 1908. The same recording pioneers, the Gisberg brothers, had caught the uniquely curdled sound of the last castrato, Alessandro Moreschi, in Rome a few years before. Capturing Joseph Taylor on 78 RPM was not quite as remarkable an act of recorded historical preservation as that, but it is a special privilege for us to hear, in this century, the traditional singing of someone who was born in the 1830s. and its influence on the contemporary folk world since a release on vinyl in the 1970s has been far-reaching.
It was on the 5th of August, the weather odd and fair, and to Brig Fair I did repair, for love I was inclined. I got up with the lark in the morning, with me heart full of glee, expecting there to meet my dear, long time I'd wish to see.
In May 1906, Granger brought back to Brig Joseph Taylor's Brig Fair in a sumptuously chromatic, unaccompanied choral arrangement. His sophisticated, ingenious and touching arrangements of this and other songs he'd transcribed in Brig the previous year must have caused quite a stir. The next year, Granger gave a copy of his arrangement of the tune to Frederick Delius, who subsequently threaded it, passacaglia-like, through his 15-minute orchestral rhapsody, Brig Fair. Joseph Taylor was invited to London for the premiere in March 1908, and Granger observed that the old man became red with pride when he recognised his song on a big orchestra. It may or may not be apocryphal, but Taylor is supposed to have stood up and sung along too. Taylor's presence at that London concert is, I think, telling, because it marks a fascinating blurring of cultural and class boundaries, a meeting of town and country when the two were hugely distinct. A traditional singer from a then relatively cut-off part of England sits in a London concert hall, amidst musically educated figures such as Granger and Delius, and hears his tune transformed into a piece of complex, notated art music. A certain kind of politically minded musicologist might brand this as cultural appropriation, a kind of stealing from the people. And certainly, if we imagine Granger with his retinue of distinguished high society hangers-on at the Winchcombe Workhouse, the idea of dredging the inmates for their folk tunes, as one of them called it, is potentially distasteful. Was there something inherently condescending and exploitative about all this folk song collection in the early years of last century? The cultured, educated elite breezing into the countryside and saving the lower classes' musical heritage for the nation. The appropriation and incorporation of folk music into art music went further back than Delius's Brig Fair, Kodaly's Dances of Galanta, or Vaughan Williams's Dives and Lazarus variants. Haydn and Beethoven arranged many hundreds of folk songs for publication, not just from German lands, but from the British Isles too. Big-hitting romantic composers, Brahms, Liszt, Dvorak, Tchaikovsky and Grieg, were not oblivious either to the charm and romping energy of local rustic tunes. What was different about all this early 20th century song collection was a dual sense of thoroughness and urgency. They wanted to get to the source, to roll up their sleeves and document this orally transmitted musical culture with meticulous application. And there was a very real fear, at a time of increasing industrialisation, mechanisation and migration off the land, that if they didn't capture these tunes, they would be lost forever. Szymanowski described the alternative community he became involved with in the southern Polish mountains in the 1920s as the emergency rescue squad of Tatra culture. Earlier, in 1907, Bartok and Kodály claimed that traditional Hungarian music was endangered by the influx of light music in the villages and mass-produced imitation folk song. It is high time for us to get down to work, they wrote, to do our patriotic duty neglected so far. Vaughan Williams's motivations for folk song collection too were wider and more idealistic than mere selfish compositional gain. Together with Cecil Sharp, his was a straightforwardly evangelical and local aim to give English folk song a massive rebirth through widespread printed dissemination in schools, to make these tunes, as VW put it, common property again. Is not folk song the bond of union where all our musical tastes can meet? Vaughan Williams wrote in 1932. One day, perhaps, we shall find an ideal music which will be neither popular nor classical, highbrow or lowbrow, but an art in which all can take part. Granger's own ideal was equally democratic and impressively cosmopolitan. He collected and arranged folk songs not just from around the British Isles, but from Scandinavia, New Zealand and the South Sea Islands. As long ago as 1915, 7 whole decades before Peter Gabriel and friends established WOMAD, the great visionary Granger wrote what was effectively a blueprint for folk and world music festivals. The article, headed Let All the World Hear All the World's Music, envisioned an international recording and touring circuit. One programme might consist of Norwegian fiddling, pipe playing, cattle calls, peasant dances and ballad singing, he wrote. Another of various types of African drumming, marimba and zanzi playing, choral songs and war dances. And yet another evening filled out with the teeming varieties of modes of singing and playing upon plucked instruments indigenous to British India. This was inspiring, far-sighted stuff indeed, but with a prescient warning too of globalisation's homogenising effect. Granger noted, "The distressing spectacle of the gentle but complex native arts wilting before the irresistible simplicity of our ruthless Western civilisation." I wonder what the 93-year-old Daddy Shepherd or the 83-year-old Archer Daddy Lane made of Granger's visit to the Winchcombe Workhouse in 1908. Was there any sense of social outrage, of being patronised, of feeling like yokel exhibits at a zoo? About their encounter specifically with new technology, Granger wrote in a Folk Song Society article that year that many of the singers he encountered were familiar with gramophones and phonographs in public houses and elsewhere, and all were agog to have their own singing recorded. Perhaps these two ancient Winchcombe residents didn't get to the pub too often. Granger's letters describe enthusiastic toil on his folk fishing trips, up with the lark, cycling 50 miles or more each day for his musical field work, enjoyable encounters with people he described as big-hearted and amusing, but naturally dirty-handed and filthy, staying up until the small hours transcribing the songs he had taken down. If that is slightly at odds with the spectacle of him turning up at the Winchcombe Workhouse in an ex-Prime Minister's grandiose motorcar, I think it's important to focus on his apparent respect for these rustic types. The greatest crime against folk song is to middle-class it, to sing it with a white-collar production and other townified suggestions, he wrote in 1952. Crucially, Granger's notebooks feature affectionate character studies alongside the musical annotations. As his article for Musical Quarterly in 1915 noted, H.G. Wells, who was with me during a folk song hunt in Gloucestershire, on noticing that I noted down not merely the music and dialect details of the songs, but also many characteristic scraps of banter that passed between the old agriculturalists, once said to me, "You are trying to do a more difficult thing than record folk songs. You are trying to record life." I wonder whether Ronald Blythe was aware of this earlier piece of social anthropology when he set out to document rural life in Suffolk for his remarkable book Aikenfield 60 years later. Granger may not have been the most assiduous of folk song collectors. His was more a fling than a long-term relationship compared with the more deeply committed Cecil Sharp. His use of the phonograph and resulting transcription techniques were controversial at the time and remain so with a band of musicologists who bat their intriguing arguments to and fro. But without those 50 or so days spent in Lincolnshire, Gloucestershire and on a Devon quayside a century ago, we wouldn't have the Taylor recordings. We wouldn't have the dozens of solo and choral arrangements. Lyrical, touching, quirky and brave. Inspiration to Benjamin Britten from the 1940s onwards in his own folk song explorations. And we certainly wouldn't have Granger's 1937 masterclass in colour, counterpoint and harmony for military band, a Lincolnshire posy. If there's any doubt that Percy Granger made friends in the fields, homesteads and workhouses of Edwardian England, the dedication in the score says it all about his warm regard and respect for the folk singers he encountered 30 years before. Knowing by then that they were all dead and gone and living himself in a very different world in upstate New York, Granger wrote simply and touchingly, "To the old folk singers who sang so sweetly to me."
Myrig Bowen. And on Wednesday evening in the essay, the pianist and writer Penelope Thwaites will be talking about Percy Grainger the Man. That's the essay Aspects of Grainger, Wednesday evening at 10:45. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 11 o'clock. Time now for Jazz on 3 with Jez Nelson.
Hello. Tonight we're revisiting two rare UK performances by elder statesmen of the American avant-garde who've taken very different paths since starting out together in Chicago over 40 years ago. Saxophonist Roscoe Mitchell had us and many of you in raptures when he performed alongside John Edwards and Tony Marsh this spring, with a previously unbroadcast set from that gig later in the programme. Firstly, though, a performance by another former member of the Chicago-based Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians Collective. But unlike Mitchell, Henry Threadgill is arguably a composer first and an instrumentalist second, drawing on everything from circus music and funk to free improv and gamelan. From his air ensemble of the 1970s through the Very Very Circus Ensemble to the Zooid Sextet that he brought to the London Jazz Festival last year, unusual instrumentation is a hallmark of Threadgill's unique musical language. This band includes acoustic bass guitar, cello and tuba, as well as Threadgill on sax and flute. Well, it's a group that through a decade of hard work together have mastered Threadgill's very complex approach. Before we hear them in action at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, here's Threadgill himself attempting to explain that to the Bad Plus's Ethan Iverson.
It took them a year to learn this language. It wasn't about the difficulty of just reading notated notes. These guys could read fly paper, all of them.
Right.
You know. But to learn the language, I like harmony. Traditional music has harmony. I haven't abandoned actually anything. Counterpoint is there.
Right.
But the harmony is an illusion. You hear this harmony, but we're not really playing it. And we're not improvising on it. But when we improvise, we can take a lot of liberties because that's what they have learned how to do. See, now the players with me, they can do anything they want to do. Because if you understand what you can do
mm-hmm.
and what you can't do, that means that you can do everything once you understand those two things.
So I'll welcome to the stage on drums, Elliot Cavie, on bass, Stoma Takeshi, on guitar, Liberty Ellman, Christopher Hoffman on cello, Jose de Villa, trombone and tuba, and on alto saxophone, flutes, the composer and the arranger and the leader of this group, Zooid. Please welcome the wonderful, the great Henry Threadgill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.